Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. New data from the International Renewable Energy Agency shows that solar energy, once four times costlier than fossil fuels, is now 41% cheaper. Similarly, offshore wind is 53% cheaper, and overall, more than 90% of new renewables worldwide beat the cheapest new fossil fuel alternative. But here in the United States, the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress are moving in the opposite direction, enacting policies that prioritize the development of fossil fuels, such as oil, coal, natural gas, over these cheaper and cleaner renewable sources like wind and solar, and cutting incentives for carbon-free electricity development. So in the wake of the Trump administration's historic rollback of environmental regulations, climate policies, tax credits, how can states like California that want to make this transition happen, how can they do so cheaply, affordably, and reliably? And what is the cost if we fail to make this transition? To discuss the path now to a fully renewable energy-powered economy, we're joined by Mark Jacobson. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of its Atmosphere and Energy Program. Mark has also developed roadmaps to transition states and countries to 100% clean renewable energy for all purposes, with computer models to examine the grid stability in the presence of high penetrations of renewable energy. And his latest book is entitled No Miracles Needed: How Today's Technology Can Save Our Climate and Clean Our Air. Good to have you back with us, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, Mark, I want to start by asking you about the energy data that I just cited. And the UN General Secretary, relying on that data, just said the following. He said, "We are on the cusp of a new era. Fossil fuels are running out of road. The sun is rising in a clean energy age." But given the rollbacks that we've just seen now at the federal level, how realistic do you think that assessment is, at least here in the United States?
Well, certainly on a worldwide level, renewables are steamrolling fossil fuels. I mean, in China, the growth rate of renewables is 10 to 20 times that of fossil fuels. And in fact, it's about 10 to 20 times that of the United States. And so China is steamrolling the United States as a whole in transition to clean renewable energy. China will be possibly 100% clean renewable energy across all energy sectors, not just electricity, but also transportation, buildings, and industry, if they go at the same pace they're going in 2024 and 2025 so far, by 2045. So within 20 years, China can have zero emissions, be 100% clean renewable energy for all purposes. Meanwhile, the United States is on track to do that only by the year past 2150, so like more than 100 years later. And however, California, on the other hand, is, and several other states are actually advancing pretty quickly. So there is a lot going on that's good at the state level in many states, including Republican states, but not at the national level at the U.S.
And then what about the future now in the United States, given these rollbacks? What are you anticipating?
Well, just to put it in perspective, just to look at where we are, in terms of electricity, the U.S. has been doing pretty good. We're about 20% renewables. When I say renewables, it's wind, solar, geothermal, and hydroelectric primarily. And the state, California, has had amazing progress. We've had 163 days now of the year out of around 207 days of the year or so that we're over 100% renewable for a part of the day. And when I say part of the day, that's like on an average of almost 5 hours a day. In fact, about almost 58% of all the electricity produced in California this year and used has been wind, water, solar type electricity. So that's progress. It's a significant increase over last year and the year before. And it's due mostly to growths in solar. We've had over the last 2 years, about a 48% growth in the solar output on the grid and about a 215% increase in the battery output on the grid. And to accompany that, gas has gone down on California's grid about 44% in the last 2 years and about 23, 24% in the last year. So there's been a rise of solar and batteries primarily, and a drop in gas, and that's what we need. And so California's grid is expected to be, if we go at the same pace we're going, within 10 years, by 2035, California's grid will be 100% renewable for 24 hours a day, with a combination of wind, solar, geothermal, hydroelectric, and batteries, primarily. Now, the rest of the US, there are actually 11 states that are doing actually better than California in terms of the fraction of their demand met by clean renewables on the grid, led by none other than South Dakota, where in the last year, basically, they've met 122% of their demand for electricity with just wind, hydroelectric, and solar produced in their state. So about 90% wind, about 30% hydroelectric, and a couple percent solar. They've also produced some gas and coal, and that all adds up to about 137% of their demand, and the excess goes to out of state. But the point is, they can meet 100% of their demand with just in-state, what we call wind, water, solar. And there, aside from South Dakota, there are also 10 other states ahead of California that have higher percentages, including Montana is like 94%, mostly hydro and wind. Iowa is close to over 80% and is mostly wind. There are actually seven out of those 11 states that are higher than California have dominated by wind, and four are dominated by hydropower. And the nice thing about those states is that of those 11 states that have higher fractions of their electricity dominated by wind, water, and solar, 10 of those 11 states have electricity prices at least 1.9 cents per kilowatt hour below the US national average. So, in other words, the more penetration you have with renewables, the lower your cost is. And there's only one state, Maine, in that group of 11 states that has high prices, and there that has nothing to do with the renewables. And California, which is number 12, also has high prices, which have nothing to do with renewables. The reason California has high electricity prices is because of several reasons. The utilities pass on to customers the cost of fires caused by transmission line sparks. In each of the last several years, there have been fires that have cost billions and billions of dollars, and who pays for that? Consumers pay for that. There have been two natural gas disasters, the San Bruno and Aliso Canyon gas disasters. Those costs have been passed on to consumers. The cost of strengthening underground gas lines, passed on to consumers. The cost of upgrading the transmission distribution system, passed on to customers. The fact that California has the second or third highest cost of fossil gas that's used to back up the grid, that goes to customers as well. Also, the cost of keeping the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant open, that's getting passed on to customers. So there are all these reasons Californians are paying high electricity prices. If we didn't have as much renewables as we have now, the prices would even be higher. So renewables on California's grid have kept prices from being even higher.
Yeah, we're
Now, go ahead.
speaking with Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University, who has developed roadmaps to transition states and countries to 100% clean renewable energy. You're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind. I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines now. If you have questions about California's electricity system. You just heard Mark discuss a little bit about electricity rates, but if you're concerned about electricity rates and want to know how those are linked to our clean energy future, the number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. And Mark, you discussed a lot of very encouraging numbers and trajectories about renewable energy deployment. So does that mean, given the fact that, as you said, California, for example, in the next 10 years, likely to be on this path of 100% clean energy, does that mean that the Republican rollbacks that we've seen with the tax bill that just passed and some of the regulatory steps to roll back support for renewable energy deployment, does that mean it's basically not going to make a bit of a difference in, or a much difference in the long run as a trajectory? And the economics of this already pretty fundamentally sound for renewable energy?
Well, it's certainly not going to help to have all these rollbacks, and especially rhetoric that's like, for example, President Trump in Europe, he's trying to say how there's not going to be another windmill, which is not the correct term. It's a wind turbine generates electricity. A windmill creates mechanical energy, like for pumping water. So, but despite it, he's really against wind. And so, he's putting every effort forward to try to stop the growth of wind in particular, but also solar. And the tax credits are phasing out. And so that's going to slow things down for sure in the United States. Fortunately, the costs are still dropping for wind and solar and batteries, battery electric vehicles, battery storage, electric heat pumps. Energy efficiency is still very important. Now, this is where the states need to step in, because if states can step in and make up for some of those disincentives, that can help. It's not that wind and solar needs on their own subsidies. In fact, they're the unsubsidized cost of wind and solar are the cheapest in the world, including in the United States, compared with gas or coal. The problem is that all energy is subsidized. So fossil fuels are subsidized, bioenergy fuels are subsidized, nuclear is subsidized. So when you're subsidizing these other fuels and energy sources, and you're not subsidizing the renewables, then if all else is the same, people are going to just go for where the more money is available, and that's where the problem is going to start. But hopefully, first of all, there's still subsidies available for a period, so hopefully there'll be a large growth of renewables before that, so we can at least keep things going for a while. And hopefully states will step in, and other action can be taken. So there is still hope that, because even under Trump before in the last administration, there was still progress. But even in that case, though, the federal tax credits were maintained during that period. Now they're trying to phase those out, or they have phased them out, but based on the new tax law. So there is a concern that things will slow down. The rest of the world is going to just pass us by. That's the unfortunate part. Because the rest of the world sees it's just going to cost the United States jobs. It's going to cost it more land. Fossil fuels take up more land. Like, they occupy 1.3% of all U.S. land right now. And biofuels, for ethanol for transportation, which supplies only 4% of U.S. transportation energy, takes up another 1.24% of land. So the fossil fuel plus bioenergy industry take up about 2.5% of U.S. land. If you transition the entire United States for all purposes, that's electricity, transportation, buildings, and industry, to just wind, water, solar powering all that, then you'd take up only around 1% of land. So you use much less land with clean, renewable energy, despite what people claim, because you need to keep the difference between renewables and fossils is that you need continuous mining and refining of energy and transporting of energy every day just to run your fossil fuel vehicles. Like, you need to pump oil every single day. You need to dig for gas every single day for the rest of eternity for those fuels. Whereas with wind and solar, you have no more mining for fuels. The wind comes right to the turbine, solar comes right to the panel. So you're in North America, just central North America alone, there are 50,000 new oil and gas wells drilled every year. So how can that not just take up huge amounts of land over time? It's just increasing amount of land occupied by the fossil fuel industry, and that's going to go on forever if you want to keep drilling for fuels. So there's you don't need that. So you save land with renewables, you create far more jobs, you save a huge amount of money. Your energy costs would go down about 60% if your annual energy costs for consumers go down about 60% with renewables. Why is that? Because when you electrify transportation, buildings, and industry, and you get rid of fossil fuels, you eliminate about 54% of your energy requirements. Because, first of all, about 12% of all energy is used to mine, transport, and refine fossil fuels and uranium. You don't need that anymore when you get rid of fossil fuels. And then electric vehicles use about each electric vehicle uses about 75% less energy than a gasoline vehicle. Each electric heat pump uses 75% less energy than a gas heater for your home. Each electric induction cooktop uses about 60% less energy than a gas cooker for your food. So when you use electric appliances and machines or replace fossil fuel ones, you reduce energy requirements substantially, and it adds up to about 54% reduction. And then the cost per unit energy is another 15% lower with renewables. So you get about 60% reduction of annual energy costs with renewables. So not doing that means your energy costs are going to go up. And this is why people are going to pay like lots more money if we keep going fossil fuel route. You
Well,
also
that
have energy
models
security problems too.
and models out of Princeton with this new tax bill show that we're likely to see some significant inflationary pressure because of the tax credits that will be rolled back for projects coming online shortly for renewable energy projects. I want to go to the phone lines. We have Kevin from San Francisco calling in. Kevin, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you for taking my call. As part of a remodeling project I started many years ago on my house here in San Francisco, I converted to all electric, completely disconnected the gas. And one of the facts that I never hear promoted when it's being talked about PV and alternative energy is the fact that for every kilowatt hour or unit of electricity that someone consumes in their house, PG&E has to generate 3 kilowatts or units of electricity to accommodate for line loss and production inefficiencies. And I overproduce electricity, and my understanding is that my overproduction, when my meter is spinning backwards, is I'm basically running my neighbor's houses. And hence, I'm saving PG&E from having to generate 3 kilowatts of electricity for every kilowatt that I pump into my neighbor's houses. And that's something I just never hear talked about as another efficiency aspect of alternative energy.
Yeah, no, thank you, Kevin, for raising that, and congratulations for going all electric. I did it myself in my home and very happy with the results. But yeah, important point about producing solar energy more locally as opposed to some of these large-scale solar facilities that I know, Mark, you're probably, you know, more, your models are more reflecting here. But what's your response about the benefits of locally produced rooftop-type solar?
No, there's so many benefits of rooftop solar. First of all, you're using your own electricity first, so you're reducing your need for grid electricity. So this helps the grid by keeping the grid more stable because it reduces the need for your electricity when there's a high demand for electricity on the grid. So, for example, this year, you know, there's this big concern that AI is going to cause huge amounts of electricity demand increases, and that also electric vehicles are going to increase electricity demand on the grid, and so is our electric heat pumps and cryptocurrency, all these additional electric demands. And in fact, so California has the most electric vehicles in the United States, over 1.3 million by far. It's like factor of five higher than Florida. And also has is the third highest data centers with around over 300 data centers. And there was a big growth of electric vehicles this year in 2025, and there's some more data centers added. But you know what? Grid electricity and demand this year on the California's main grid is like 1.5% lower than last year's, and also about 1.5% lower than the year before. And why is that? That's because even though there are more electric vehicles, et cetera, that demanding grid electricity, it's the growth of rooftop solar in California, which has skyrocketed in the last 5-6 years, that there's been a huge growth of rooftop solar, and all that rooftop solar avoids the need for grid electricity, preventing these runaway grid electricity demands that people have been afraid of and been saying in the federal government. In fact, the federal government, President Trump, issued executive orders on day one saying we have an energy emergency. We're going to need more fossil fuels to account for all this additional AI and electric cars and stuff like that. And it turns out that, and he's saying, well, we don't want solar and wind because of that. We want more fossil fuels. But that is actually because when you have rooftop solar, when you actually add rooftop solar, you prevent any of that increase of demand on the grid. And so it's basically saying, well, it's actually by trying to prevent that solar, you're actually creating the problem. So the more we try to prevent rooftop solar, the more we're creating the problem of increasing grid demand.
Yeah, sorry, Mark, I just want to ask you about Kevin's point that it actually takes three times as much electricity generated off-site to meet on-site demands given line losses and that sort of thing. I don't know if you're about to answer that question, but I just wanted to follow up. Yeah. Is that correct in your view or your understanding of the issue?
No, that's not correct, because first of all, if you're using, let's say, take the best case where you're using all your own electricity for your own use, you're not sending anything on the grid. So they're not spending a single dime on you. So let's say, though, all you're doing is exporting everything, then you're providing electricity to the grid, especially at times when the grid needs it the most. So you're reducing the burden on the grid. You're actually supplying electricity to the grid when the electricity price is high. So you're actually helping to reduce the electricity price when it's high. So that's just a fake claim that these utilities make. They make a lot of fake claims. Another benefit of having rooftop PV is you avoid the use of transmission lines. When you have utility PV or any type of utility electricity, you need the use of transmission lines. Transmission line sparks have created fires, have resulted in fires that have caused devastation. The more rooftop PV you have, the less you need to use electricity wires for transmitting electricity, and so you're reducing that risk as well. So you're not only helping people on the grid at times of peak demand by exporting electricity, you're reducing the risk of wildfires, you're avoiding the use of fossil fuels on the grid by having grid electricity and reducing grid demand. That's saving people's lives and improving their health. There's so many benefits of rooftop solar, and anybody who tells you that it's damaging or it shifts the cost to low-income people, that's just false information.
Yeah, and I think his point was that he's averting essentially three times the amount of electricity that would need to be produced because it is so much more efficient to produce
it
locally.
I didn't understand what. Okay, I thought I was saying that the utilities were spending three times as many kilowatt hours for the rooftop solar. No, I agree with that. Yeah, if you're
there's excess produced offsite. Yes. Well, I want to go back to the phone lines because we have Greg in Palo Alto dialing in. Greg, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Hello. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that things are moving, at least ostensibly, in the right direction. But I wanted to ask your guest if he could even make a prediction, which he may not be able to, and that's this. The 2015 COP said that global warming had to be kept beneath 1.5 degrees Celsius. In 2024, that was exceeded multiple times during the year. It might have been exceeded for most of the year. I think I'm wondering if he sees what this progress in moving towards cleaner electricity is going to be able to prevent, and this is by 2030, this had to be kept down. Does he see us not exceeding 2 degrees Celsius by 2030?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, Greg, thank you for that. Yeah, Mark, how does this play into our ultimate objective here, which is try to limit the damage from climate change and keep global warming, you know, under 2 degrees if possible?
Well, yeah, we're already on the cusp of 1.5 degrees global warming on average from the 1850 to 1900 period, as pointed out in the 2024 data. And of course, any one year, you have to look at a trend over many years to see what that actual average is, but we're pretty close to 1.5. And you know, it is possible theoretically, if we do this on a worldwide scale, to eliminate 80% of all emissions by 2030 and 100% of emissions by 2050, then we could get carbon dioxide down by 2100 to about 350 parts per million. And concomitantly, you know, if we're at 1.5 degrees right now, we're going to see an increase for a while for sure, no matter, even if we stop emissions because of the accumulation that's already occurred in the atmosphere and the time lag that occurs. Mm-hmm. But you will see eventually the temperatures dropping if we stopped emissions today. So I think, you know, we can only do the best we can do, which is stop as much emissions as possible, eliminate emissions as fast as possible. And that means the only way to do this on a large scale quickly is to electrify everything we can, go to electric vehicles, electric heat pumps, electric industry, electric cooking, and get rid of combustion. Combustion is the problem, and go to clean renewable energy supplying the electricity. So wind, solar, geothermal, hydro primarily, and we'll need storage as well. So if we do that as fast as possible, not only in the US, but India, China, European Union, everywhere in the world, then we do have hope to solve the climate problem. And the other problem is the air pollution problem. 7.5 million people die every year from air pollution worldwide, including 100,000 in the US. And this is, if you stopped emissions today, you would eliminate, you know, almost all of those deaths immediately. I mean, those are mostly short-term deaths, and you know, some are long-term, but you'd eliminate most of those deaths immediately. So there's, and also reduce global warming. So there's motivation to act quickly, but we can only do the best we can. And if we do eliminate 80% emissions worldwide by 2030, which is very unlikely, but still a goal, and 100% by 2050, then we do have a hope to solve these two problems.
And Mark, I also wanted to ask about tariffs. I mean, in addition to the Trump administration's rollbacks for regulatory support, tax credits, we're seeing tariffs that could potentially affect renewable energy deployment more than fossil fuel if it's more sort of material intensive to get some of these facilities up and running. The fuel, obviously, once they're up and running, is free from the wind and the sun. But will these tariffs disproportionately hurt renewable energy deployment here in the United States?
Certainly, any tariff is going to cause damage to the transition because it's just an additional cost people are going to have to pay, and especially businesses. And so there's less incentive to do a project if you're having to pay a lot more money for it. And especially if the tariff is selective and it's more focused on the renewable technologies and the fossil fuels are exempted, which they could be in some cases, and they're also subsidized. So yeah, there's no benefit of the tariff from a transition point of view. The costs are low, but we need to keep those costs low in order to affect a large scale, fast transition.
And we're speaking with Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of its Atmosphere and Energy Program. His latest book is entitled No Miracles Needed: How Today's Technology Can Save Our Climate and Clean Our Air. We're talking to him about the current and future state of renewable energy deployment in the United States. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're going to go to break a bit late here because we want to stay with Mark for another few minutes. If you do have any questions about renewable energy, about the future of energy in California, in the United States as a whole, love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. Mark, I want to ask you about some other fossil or carbon-free electricity sources, namely nuclear power, which is carbon-free, but of course has other impacts on the environment, and then geothermal, just to name a couple. How do those technologies factor in to your projections, to what you think is needed for a clean energy future?
Well, I'll start with geothermal. Conventional geothermal is usually near like volcanic activity or tectonic plates, is only available in like 13 states. California is one of those. And that's really good, but it's kind of limited in terms of where it's available. What's called enhanced geothermal, which is basically the same, but you dig deeper, and the deeper you go, the hotter it gets. And so you can find hot temperatures pretty much anywhere with enhanced geothermal. And because of low cost drilling now, that's actually possible. So that, I think, is a great technology because it doesn't take up much land and it provides stable power. You can use that enhanced geothermal to power an off-grid data center even. So you don't need small modular nuclear reactors anymore because the enhanced geothermal, you can get that running within 3 years. Nuclear takes, on average in the world, anywhere in the world, it's 12 to 23 years from planning to operation of any nuclear plant in the world. In enhanced geothermal, you can do that in 3 years. You get stable power. So that avoids the need for any of these small nuclear reactors for anything. And you can use it for helping with grid electricity. California actually has an agreement now to bring in Southern California 300 megawatts of enhanced geothermal from Utah. The company Fervo Energy is building a commercial plant there. Nuclear, on the other hand, it's not helpful one bit. I mean, there's a difference between existing nuclear and new nuclear. I'll just say with existing nuclear, well, it's only beneficial if you don't have to subsidize it. And unfortunately, though, pretty much all nuclear plants are so uneconomical that the owners are asking for subsidies for the existing plants. And this is just a waste and keeping an albatross of energy open at high cost when you could just replace that nuclear plant with the subsidy alone, usually with sufficient wind and solar to replace and you're going to have to replace the nuclear plant anyway. I mean, all these subsidies are just extending the plants, not keeping them open for a long time. Yeah. So you're going to have to replace them anyway. You might as well use the subsidy money just to replace them right away with clean, renewable energy. New plants, they suffer from multiple problems. You know, aside from delays, it's in the North America and Europe, it's 17 to 23 years from planning to operation. Worldwide, it's 12 to 23 years. It's just too long to help anything. If it takes 17 years, that's like your next new plant will be 2042 if we plant it today. That's way too late to help with any climate or pollution problem. So it's not useful. The costs are 16 times higher the capital cost of wind and solar. It has weapons proliferation issues, meltdown risk, waste mining issues, underground uranium lung cancer mining risk, and it's not carbon free, actually. It's about 9 to 37 times the carbon equivalent emissions as wind.
Yeah, all right. Well, probably worth a whole other show on nuclear alone, but I appreciate you walking through those technologies. I know we're almost out of time. We have to let you go, but we do have a caller, Jeff in San Francisco, dialing in. So I wanted to be able to take Jeff's call. Welcome to Your Calls One Planet series, Jeff.
Oh, thank you. Just a quick comment. It seems to me that encouraging development of solar presents a real opportunity for moving substantial manufacturing back to the United States. I'd be interested in your comments.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Jeff. Well, on the jobs point then, Mark, what is your thoughts or your model show in terms of job production that could happen here domestically if we did move to this, you know, more fully to this clean energy future?
Well, rooftop solar in particular is the most job productive energy technology there is. I mean, you create more jobs with rooftop solar than any other technology, even utility scale solar. But rooftop and utility scale solar do create a lot of jobs compared with any type of fossil fuel for sure. So that's different, but there's also that's the installations mostly, but the actual building of the solar panels, yeah, there's potential there for more U.S. production of solar panels. A lot of solar panels are built elsewhere, but solar panels have, you know, hundreds of parts, and the parts, different parts come from different places in the world. But still, yeah, manufacturing more locally can help. Manufacturing wind turbines locally can help. But overall, you know, if we want a really fast transition, we want to reduce costs. So any type of tariff that tries to encourage this is, I mean, you might have some local benefit, but on a larger scale, there's a disbenefit from the tariff.
And Mark, any closing thoughts on what you would like to see policy-wise, what maybe a state should be doing, what ideally could be happening at the federal level to help usher in this transition more rapidly?
Well, just from my experience, you know, the real key is to focus on a goal, not to get distracted with all sorts of bells and whistles. So focus on clean renewable energy. So it's electrification, electrify all energy. So electric cars, electric heat pumps, electric induction cooktops, electric industry, and provide the electricity with clean renewable sources. In people's own homes, they can do a lot. You can replace a gas heater with an electric heat pump, air heater or water heater. You can go to electric induction cooktop. You can add energy efficiency up in your home, more electric efficient appliances, efficient electric appliances. So focus, don't get distracted with things like small, large nuclear reactors. Those are just useless, not going to help anything. They just can't be built in any useful time. And they have all sorts of side issues associated with them. If you've heard of carbon capture, direct air capture, blue hydrogen, and electrofuels, those are all constructs of the fossil fuel industry. So just keep your blinders on. Just don't pay attention to those things, because those are just useless technologies that all they do is promote the extension of fossil fuels. And then there's the bioenergy. The agricultural people are pushing biofuels and biomass. Try to stay away from that. That's just, you're still burning things, still creating air pollution. You're still creating greenhouse gases that affect climate and huge amounts of land usually. So focus on clean renewable energy and storage for everything as much as possible. Electrification, focus on the obvious. That's the obvious. And energy efficiency, of course. And keep hope up. We can solve this problem. The numbers are there. We have to stay together and work together to solve this problem.
Yeah, move faster. Well, it's so wonderful to have your perspective. Thank you so much, Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford. His latest book is entitled No Miracles Needed, How Today's Technology Can Save Our Climate and Clean Our Air. Thank you so much for coming on Your Calls One Planet series to talk about renewable energy and its future.
Thanks, Ethan.
And coming up next, we're going to talk about how Texas officials ignored warnings about the flood risks, like what we just saw in Kerr County, Texas. So stay with us. We'll be back just after this short break.